Think on your feet for our Fast and Curious 5K, a one-of-a-kind race hosted by WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times on Saturday, July 27th at Humboldt Park. More info and early bird registration at wbez.org/events.
As migrant evictions from city shelters begin, we are looking back to earlier rounds of migration to Chicago. I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. More than 37,000 migrants have arrived in the city over the past year and a half. And there are quite a few historical parallels between what's happening now and what's happened in the past. A recent WBEZ data analysis identified multiple periods of Chicago's history when we experienced waves of new arrivals. We checked in with WBEZ data reporter Amy Chin and UIC history professor Lilia Fernandez to learn more. Here's Amy.
Late last year, politics reporter Tessa Weinberg and I, we were kind of chatting about ways to think about adding context to the migrant crisis. And one of the main questions we had is, you know, with this 37,000 migrants coming in such a short period of time, whether or not that was historically, you know, had happened before. Mm-hmm. And we both knew that Chicago has this rich history of immigration and migration, but we weren't sure if the number of people coming in a given period of time was, comparable to these historic periods.
Yeah.
So that's kind of why.
We'll dig into some of the specifics of what you found, of course, in our conversation. But I mean, once you gathered the data, what would you say overall were some of the biggest takeaways?
Yeah, so we looked at historical census data going all the way back to 1850. And what we found is that there are kind of these three main periods in Chicago's history when the city saw more new arrivals and migrants coming. And that is, you know, European immigration during the turn of the 20th century, the Great Migration during the middle of the 20th century, and Mexican immigration and migration in the 1990s and early 2000s. And
yeah.
I think, you know, throughout all of these periods, there were tens of thousands of newcomers coming to Chicago each decade. And, you know, at one point in the city's history in the late 1800s,
mm-hmm.
Nearly half of the city's population was born abroad. So these
really?
Were foreign-born folks coming to Chicago. And yeah, I mean, it was a very different city back then. But I think one point that Mulia underscored in our conversation was that, you know, unless you're indigenous to the land we call Chicago today, you can probably trace back your lineage, whether you're a migrant yourself or, you know, your parents, your grandparents, back to somewhere else that wasn't Chicago.
Right. Yeah, Professor Fernandez, I think the point Amy's making there too is that Chicago is a city of immigrants, right? How do you think that that should influence our approach to this current moment?
Well, I think it would be important for people to keep that in mind when they're looking at the media coverage, the news that in many ways is shining a lot of light on this issue, or generating a lot of heat, I should say. However, what they should understand is that this is not unique or unprecedented, that immigration is a historical phenomenon. It's also a global one.
Yeah.
So what Chicago's experiencing is not unique either. We're seeing people leaving their homes throughout the world, going to Europe, migrating within Asia, Latin America, et cetera. The other thing is that I think it's important for people to consider long-term causes and the reasons behind this migration. It's not accidental. It's not unexpected mm-hmm. that we've seen so many people leaving Venezuela. Any observer of U.S. relations with Latin America, and particular our foreign policy with Venezuela,
mm-hmm.
could see this coming over the last 2.5 decades. That it's been building up. Our policies in Venezuela and Latin America have contributed to the conditions there that have prompted people to leave.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to, you know, things like natural disasters, global warming, political upheaval, turmoil.
Yeah. And to your earlier point, Professor, I mean, Chicago's got this very rich history. We're home to the Ojibwe, Potawatomi, Ottawa, and Miami, and many more tribes and nations. When we talk about people arriving here in Chicago, it is important to point out that people were pushed out and forced to give up their lands. Right, Professor?
Absolutely. Yes. And, You know, I think the other important thing is that when we think about human migration in general, you know, one of the big arguments we hear these days is that people don't object to immigration, you know, in principle. What they oppose is illegal or unauthorized migration. And the question I would put back to those commentators is, how do you migrate to the U.S. legally today? Mm. What constitutes legal migration? What made migration legal historically in the past? And what does it take to get the right authorization and paperwork to be able to move from another country here to the U.S.?
Yeah.
And if people explore that, they'll see that it's actually very, very complicated, very difficult, and can take years, even decades.
Yeah. Well, let's talk more about the data sets that you looked at, Amy. As you said, you started back in the 1860s or so. Walk us through some more of the history that you found.
1850 was the first census that we had access to. Mm-hmm. And we looked at places people were born, whether that was different states in the U.S. or different countries. We also looked at information on migration. The mm-hmm. census keeps track of where people lived a year ago and 5 years ago. And yeah, what we found is that, you know, starting even before 1850, the first census information, like professors mentioned, you know, there were a lot of these kind of early European settlers, business people from the East Coast who kind of, after 1833, after a lot of these native tribes were pushed out of the region, saw opportunity. They saw that, you know, as settlers, they could come and make business here. And so mm-hmm. they were the first folks to come here from elsewhere. But then, you know, later on in the late kind of 1800s, early 1900s, you start to see kind of more Europeans from Southern and Eastern Europe who looked very different from these kind of early settlers. They were typically escaping poverty, upheaval in their homelands, and didn't come with as many resources. And so, yeah.
And as you said, there was a period there where nearly half of Chicagoans were born in Europe.
Yeah.
Right? We'll get into some historical patterns of xenophobia and racism in this city. Give us an overview of what you found.
Yeah. So, you know, starting in 1860, 1870, the majority of these European migrants were from places like Germany and England. But then it starts to shift kind of in the early 1900s when they start to come from Italy, Poland, Ireland. Yeah. When the kind of later group of European migrants came, they faced a lot of difficulties like any other new immigrants would. They didn't know the language. Many of them faced housing segregation. They were forced to live in these kind of crowded tenements on the near west side of the city. Mm-hmm. They faced a lot of discrimination in work. They weren't allowed to join the same trade unions as other Europeans. And actually, a lot of them weren't viewed as white when they came. You know, this past weekend with St. Patrick's Day was a reminder that a lot of Irish Americans live here. And when their ancestors first came, they faced a lot of discrimination, weren't mm-hmm. viewed as the same kind of white as, you know, English or German folks.
Yeah. And caught up in there, too, is a history of people providing service to newcomers. You write in your story about Jane Addams and Hull House.
Yeah, so that was really interesting. So Jane Addams, she was born in Illinois and was college educated, which was very rare for a woman at the time. But she's a sort of social reformer and activist who started Hull House in 1889. And Hull House is this settlement house, which was this kind of community hub for social services, modeled off of kind of their European counterparts. And it provided a lot of social services like English classes, art classes, daycare, any kind of assistance a new immigrant to the United States would need.
Yeah.
And it was located on the near west side where a lot of these immigrants lived. And yeah, it eventually grew it from one house to an entire block.
Wow.
But the interesting thing is that, you know, today we see a lot of kind of similarities with these nonprofits, religious
groups. It sounds very familiar.
Yes.
Now, before we get the professor's take, I just want you to tell us your biggest takeaways during the Great Migration.
Yeah, so the Great Migration was a period where you saw widespread movement of Black Southerners to northern cities and cities on the West Coast as they were escaping a lot of racial violence and Jim Crow laws in the South. And, you know, nationally during this time, I think estimates find that over 6 million Black Southerners migrated. And Chicago was one of the most popular destinations for these people. And you can see that in the data. The city's Black population was roughly 40,000 residents in 1900 and grew to over a million people in 1980, which is kind of the rear end of the Great Migration. And so that's like a 25-fold difference.
Right.
So each decade, there are tens of thousands of new migrants from the South coming to Chicago. And at one point, you know, from 1910 to 1950, Black residents born in the South made up the majority of the city's Black population. And as they came, they settled and, you know, formed families and really made lives here. But of course, you know, they faced a lot of discrimination and a lot of the same kind of systemic inequalities they were escaping.
So, Professor, connect the dots for us, right? We're seeing parallels. We're seeing, you know, we're talking about people fleeing racist violence in the South and now, 2024, 2023, 2022, people seeking asylum here in Chicago and other cities across the country. And, you know, even as people are leaving their home countries to escape, you know, turbulent situations, both Black people who are coming from the South and now the migrants, mostly from Venezuela, I mean, they're still encountering that othering, racism, xenophobia. So talk through that.
Yes, exactly. I think that there's a lot of fear among local populations over newcomers, especially when they don't know a whole lot about their culture, their background, and when it gets, you know, overblown in the media at times. One of the things that I think, you know, we can appreciate that connects all of these different population movements is, one, you know, people looking for better circumstances to improve their conditions, their economic, their, you know, social, personal conditions. But also there's the demand for labor. People didn't start coming north, or people didn't start coming to Chicago just, you know, on a whim, on their own, by accident. They knew that there were jobs here.
They needed work.
African Americans in the South knew that there was a lot of industrial employment in the northern cities like Chicago. And that's been true throughout the 19th and 20th centuries. So whether you're talking about immigrants coming from Europe, white Appalachian migrants coming from, you know, southern states like Tennessee, Kentucky, African Americans coming from the South, or Latin American migrants coming from Mexico, and increasingly in the last few decades from Central America and South America, people are going to places where they know that there are jobs potentially, where there's a chance to earn better wages, and where they can, you know, try to improve their lives.
Things changed in 1980, Amy.
Yeah, so that was the year that Chicago's Black population started to decline. And, you know, like Professor mentioned, you know, a lot of people started leaving due to the fact that a lot of these manufacturing jobs were no longer in the city. A lot of these kind of same inequalities like redlining, disinvestment, urban renewal, the building of expressways literally through people's neighborhoods really made it difficult to live in the city. And so from 2000 to 2020, Chicago actually lost more Black residents than almost every other city in the U.S., except for Detroit. So the city lost about 250,000 of its Black residents.
Wow. Yeah, so policies like redlining really influencing whether people felt that they could stay here. You know, they might have come for these job opportunities, et cetera, but it, in a lot of cases, was uncomfortable to be in places like here. And it's also a reminder that what we do now impacts the future and begs the question, Professor, I mean, who feels safe to be here?
That is a good question, particularly at a moment when Chicago is experiencing such dramatic inequality. I mean, I was born and raised here, and so I remember the Chicago of the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Mm. It looks nothing like what you see today in terms of all of the redevelopment, all the downtown high-rises, all of the very opulent, luxurious real estate that has sprouted all over. And so I think a lot of observers, a lot of residents in the city today perhaps may not be familiar with that history and don't understand that a lot of people have left the Chicago area, even among the Latino population. There are more Latinos in the suburbs today than there are in the city proper because it's become so unaffordable.
And on that point, I want to briefly touch on the 90s. It's a trend you identify, Amy, the Mexican migration, right? And we saw an uptick there in folks coming. And then when we fast forward, you know, we had roughly 4,000 Venezuelans living in Chicago in 2020, but not many Venezuelan-specific neighborhoods, unlike what we've got for the Mexican population. So sort of talk through that.
Yeah, so, I mean, the migration from Mexico hit its peak around the 1990s. But before that, Mexicans have been coming to Chicago for decades. With the passage of the 1924 Immigration Act, basically, it allowed just very few immigrants from most countries to come to the U.S. Because they were afraid of foreign labor, you know, basically taking away jobs from white Americans. But the exception to that rule was Mexican laborers. Mm-hmm. And so there was legislation that basically encouraged Mexican farm workers to come to the United States and gave them temporary contracts to live on farms. And so that was kind of what started a lot of the migration from Mexico.
Yeah.
And during this period, you know, people started settling in places like Pilsen and Back of the Yards, these neighborhoods that we know today as kind of predominantly Mexican American. But yeah, that trend kind of hit its peak in the 1990s. Yeah. As
it already sounds like their experience was different, their migration experience, Mexicans versus Venezuelans of today.
Yeah, absolutely, because they already had a pretty significant population here mm-hmm. after multiple decades. And many people, you know, came because they had family here or, you know, came through word of mouth or had existing social connections. And like you mentioned, you know, Chicago doesn't have a Venezuelan neighborhood, per se. And so a lot of these Venezuelans who are coming, they don't have existing connections.
Where do I fit in?
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
So, Professor, let's tie this together. We were talking about how policy really influences these patterns of migration over history. What lessons would you say that Chicago should learn and apply to policy today?
I think that we need to take seriously American foreign policy in these sending nations and draw the connections and understand the linkages there.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, it's not a coincidence, it's not a surprise to any student of U.S. foreign policy in Latin America, whether in Central America or Venezuela or other places, to see so many people leaving those countries most recently. In fiscal year 2020, there were about 4,500 Venezuelans at the U.S.-Mexico border.
Yeah.
In fiscal year 2023, over 265,000. And
huge difference.
Yes. And in total, there have been 7 million Venezuelans who've left their home country. The majority of them, obviously, are not coming here to the U.S., but it's our economic sanctions, our embargoes, the foreign aid or lack thereof that we provide to these countries mm-hmm. that is fueling that migration. And I'll just point out, you know, one other point to consider, that the U.S. gives the 33 nations of Latin America and the Caribbean combined
yeah.
about $3 billion in foreign aid annually, okay? 33 nations in Latin America and the Caribbean, $3 billion in aid annually combined.
Yeah.
That's the same amount it gives to just one country, to Israel, every year. And we're talking about huge, you know, hugely different populations, 9 million people versus 650 million people.
Right.
Compare that to Ukraine as well, which, by the way, has been another major sending country of refugees to Chicago, but it's gotten a lot less media attention.
Yeah, there's been a lot of coverage, too, about how U.S. policy for Venezuelans, for instance, compares to U.S. policy for Ukrainians.
Right.
Differences there.
Yes.
Yeah. So you point out that it's been, in part, U.S. policy sort of creating the conditions that has led Venezuelans to even come here, mm-hmm. too. So that dynamic is pretty interesting.
Yes.
Right? Like we're driving these people here, but then how do we take care of them once they're here?
Right. And then, you know, if we're surprised when they arrive, I think we need to kind of step back for a moment and look and say, well, what's going on? What's the bigger picture? Because it's very easy, I think, to just kind of look at the individuals mm-hmm. who we're encountering or who are arriving at these shelters, who are showing up at our doorstep, and think of them just as, you know, individual stories, which they, you know, they each have their own story, of course, and they've struggled on their journey to get here. But there are much larger forces at play, larger structural conditions that are shaping this and that are driving
yes.
this.
You started out, Amy, talking about, you know, Tessa and I were looking into, you know, whether this really is unprecedented. I mean, is there anything unprecedented here in this moment?
I mean, that's a great question. I feel like it's just a matter of like history repeating itself.
Yeah.
But I think there are a lot of key differences with this moment. I think we've touched on that throughout this conversation. You know, people in the past, they were coming because there were jobs or they knew people here or, you know, over many decades, people from their hometowns came to Chicago.
Yeah.
You know, in this moment, it's kind of like people are being sent. They're being bused literally to Chicago. And so they're coming without a lot of context, with a lot of context.
We're a sanctuary city, right?
Yeah.
In practice.
But, you know, 37,000 people in a year and a half is not nothing for
yeah.
city like ours.
The other thing I would point out that is unprecedented is that, unfortunately, these migrants today don't have the legal right to work in the U.S., whereas in the past, we were much laxer on those regulations. And so you notice one of the things that many of the people that porters interview, one of the things that they point out is they don't have work permits.
Right.
So they cannot legally work in the United States. And that, of course, makes them much more visible mm-hmm. because they're on the streets. It makes it much more difficult for
That's
them to support themselves.
That's an ongoing journey that they're going to have to deal with. We'll have to pause the conversation here for now. That's Lilia Fernandez, who's a history professor at the University of Illinois at Chicago. And we've also been talking with WBEZ data reporter Amy Chin. Fascinating stuff. Thank you.
Thank you.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced and mixed by Max Louvers and edited by Meha Ahmed. For more on the migrant crisis in Chicago, scroll back in our podcast feed or check out a full archive of our interviews at wbez.org/reset. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Thanks for listening.
Have you ever wondered why anyone drinks Malort? Or if there are actually lobsters in the Chicago River? Then listen to the Curious City podcast, where we answer all your questions about Chicago and the region. WBEZ's Curious City is part of the NPR network and available wherever you find your podcasts.